Drop the confetti, start the parade, and raise the banner. The Chicago White Sox have won a baseball game. The streak is dead at 21 games. We will talk about that and a whole lot more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world. Wearing White Sox this morning in honor of those lovable losers. I'm Jake Mance. That's Jordan Schusterman. White Sox or Black Sox for you?
That's a good place to start. I'm a big Black Sox guy. I really
you would
don't...
you gambling cheater?
Yeah, that's me. I guess that is why I refuse to wear white socks. I never really thought about that. I don't know. I think I just adopted black socks as a, you know, if not, you know, some more colorful patterned socks, of which I also enjoy. But I am almost never wearing just white socks. And honestly, it was because I didn't want to be associated with this baseball team. I think I kind of saw this losing streak and this historically bad season coming, and I didn't want to be caught wearing white socks in the year 2024, and that's paid off. That's really paid off for me here.
That's what we're going to open with today. The Chicago White Sox won a Major League Baseball game last night in Oakland, snapping their streak at 21 consecutive losses. We will also do a little awards check-in. How are things going with the AL MVP, the NL MVP, the Cy Youngs, and the Rookies of the Year? Baseball goes to the racetrack. Fascinating story there with the Braves and Reds set to play a game at Tennessee's Bristol Motor Speedway. And we will talk about Billy Beane, the incredibly important figure in baseball history who passed away yesterday at the age of 60. Billy Beane was the believed to be the second player to come out as gay. After their playing career, he then became a kind of a liaison for Major League Baseball for inclusion. He passed away. Super, super interesting legacy. So we'll talk a little bit about Billy Beane and kind of how LGBTQ rights and visibility are functioning in baseball today. But let's begin with the White Sox, who stink. No amount of wins the rest of the season will take that away. If they win every game the rest of the year, they will still stink. That is a fact. I love the idea that they went out and have the longest win streak in baseball history and still finish with 88 losses.
So if they, right. So they're at, you know, they're at 88 losses. So, you know, 88 losses is a pretty normal bad season. So if they, I mean, if they win out, I do think if they win out, probably we're feeling a lot better about them next year because all these players that are on their team that we think aren't good will have won for, you know, 2 months straight. And now it's like, okay, they didn't get into the postseason this year because, you know, they were horrible for the first 4 months. And then suddenly they were the best team in baseball. But I do think if they won out, I would definitely feel a lot better about their 2025 for sure. But I don't think that's going to happen. So for now, we have to celebrate every individual W, which for most teams, even for the bad teams, as we've said, is not usually that big of a deal. But when it is just your 28th win of the season on August 6th, it is certainly worth discussing further.
The White Sox had not won a game since July 10th. This is like the part where I want to put on the Sunday night countdown 7 minute drill, Chris Berman music, like
to go through all the losses. You mean
go through every loss? So they hadn't won since July 10th, which is a long, long freaking time. Last night before the game in Oakland, the Oakland Coliseum was playing 22 by Taylor Swift to try and push the A's forward to Chicago's 22nd consecutive loss. That did not
work. They were feeling it. They were feeling 22, but Jonathan Cannon had other ideas.
That's for sure. So what happens in the game? Two very simple things. Jonathan Cannon, the starter for the Chicago White Sox, a rookie pitcher from the University of Georgia, was very good. He threw six innings. He allowed just one run. If you do that, chances are, usually more often than not, your team will win the baseball game. Opposing him was Mr. Chicken Strip, Ross Stripling, who's just a thunderdome of mid right now, with all due respect to Ross, who's a very lovely guy. He throws a 91-mile-an-hour goose ball down the pipe to Andrew Benintendi, who cranks a two-run ding-dong to give the White Sox an early lead. A lead they would never relinquish, despite Zach Geloff doing his best with a solo shot. They add a couple more. They tack on three more runs, and the bullpen shuts it down. Dominic Leone to Chad Kuhl to John Brebbia, and the Chicago White Sox do the damn thing. Before we dig a little bit deeper, we're going to peel back the curtain here. A little inside joke Jordan and I have. So our head of school, I believe, when we were in middle school together and elementary school for you, was a gentleman named Jonathan Cannon. Not the same Jonathan Cannon
who
was
no.
pitched for the White Sox last night. And our Jonathan Cannon was very British. And he would talk to the whole school kind of like this about the Old Testament. And he was very...
he was great. Very, like, he was great a guy. Lovely, lovely guy who we all very much enjoyed his presence as our fearless leader of the Jewish Day School. However, when Jonathan Cannon, the baseball pitcher, emerged as a prospect at the University of Georgia, we were like, hold on a second. We got another Johnny Cannon in our life. This is really something to behold. Also, all the way to the point where when Jonathan Cannon was at the Futures game last year, we told him, like, hey, dude, no pressure, but we would love to see you become a great major league pitcher if only that we can, you know, make reference back to our head of school for the entirety of your career. And so leading up to this moment was really something. And Jonathan Cannon, again, third round pick, he debuted a few months ago, has been pitching like really well. In July, he made five starts, went six innings in every start. He doesn't strike out a lot of guys, but he throws enough different pitches and throws enough strikes to get through a lot of the game. He's not overwhelming people, but like he is doing enough right that he can munch innings, right? But he went 0-5, or the team went 0-5 in those five starts in July because, as we mentioned, the White Sox kept losing. And so for this one, this felt like a good matchup here. This really felt like, you know, Monday that Kai Bush major league debut, it was bad from the start. Jonathan Cannon had been rolling. And so this is really was a great matchup. I know Oakland's offense is decent, but he was the stopper. I had a good feeling he would be the stopper.
Can we start calling him the principal? Even though our Jonathan Cannon was not the principal of our school.
He's head of pitching.
Head of pitching. That's so good. Are you wearing a Kannapolis Cannonballers hat for the Chicago White Sox or for Jonathan Cannon?
Both. It is the double entendre that I didn't realize I had. Indeed, Jonathan Cannon's major professional career started with the Cannonballers. A couple of these players on this team, including Brooks Baldwin, another rookie player who was called up on July 19th and had to endure 16 straight losses in the majors before he got to, you know, slap hands at the end of a game and know what that feels like. So good for him. And obviously, a lot of these players, I mean, we've talked about this before. You know, what has led them to this point has a lot more to do with their bosses than them themselves. They are not equipped. This is not a talented enough team to win a lot of Major League Baseball games, but it is a talented enough team to win a Major League Baseball game, as any Major League team is. And as they talk about all the time, if you are not good enough and you're not ready to go, no matter who you're playing in the big leagues, you're going to get your ass kicked. And so I know Pedro Grifol was the one when he got introduced saying, you know, we're going to kick your ass. And that has not been happening. They've been getting their ass kicked since he became the manager. But it was nice for the players. And we know some of these, right? Chad Kuhl, you know, some of these guys that are just on this team as major leaguers. And especially some of these younger guys. We mentioned Cannon and Baldwin, who are trying to get their major league careers off the ground. It's nice to see them win a game.
Many of the players on the stinky butt Chicago White Sox are good enough to be the 21st or 17th or 24th player on a good to decent major league team, right? Like if John Brebbia was throwing the sixth inning for you and giving you bullpen depth, you wouldn't really bat an eye. You might be frustrated when he does bad. You'd be happy when he does good. I would say even Andrew Benintendi, who was horrible for 4 months, has looked like a completely competent reserve outfielder over the last however many weeks. Now, granted, he's not being paid to do that. I understand. My point is that these are major league players, and these are major league players with a whole lot of pride. And what has happened in Chicago over the last few weeks is none of their own faults individually. And I can imagine that there was a certain weight of embarrassment that these gentlemen were carrying around with them over the last 3 weeks, where they don't want to do this. They want to show up and they want to win baseball games. And I feel for these players having to answer the questions that the media is completely in their right to ask about how it feels to be a part of infamy, right? Because it's not as if it's any of their singular faults. A couple funny quotes from yesterday I just want to go over. One is from Pedro Grifol, who has baseball boy brain rot. Like, his head is so close to the screen that his quote reads so funny. I'm just going to read it. Anytime you win, it's great. Anytime,
I mean, yeah.
You
good start.
Yeah. This is from Sam Blum's article in The Athletic. Shouts out Sam Blum. Quote, anytime you win, it's great, said beleaguered White Sox manager Pedro Grifol. Beleaguered as hell. Quote, anytime you win, when you lose 21 in a row, it's even better. Unbelievable. Everything in baseball speak is derived from the history of baseball, right? That the sheer number of games pushes everything back to equilibrium. And so nothing can either take us too high or too low. We are always drawing from the past. However, the Chicago White Sox were one loss away, from the all-time American League record and two away from the all-time record. And so for Pedro Grifol to say, anytime when you lose 21 in a row and then you pull it out, it's a great feeling. It sounds like he's saying winning on a getaway day. Oh, that's a great feeling, right?
Anytime you come back, anytime, you know, you're down in the eighth and you come back and score, that feels extra good.
Anytime your starter, you know, can only go three and your bullpen steps up, that's a great feeling. Like, no, Pedro, this is not
any time.
I can't relate to you in this circumstance. It's like when they cut to the, you know, these Olympians and they're like, you know what the feeling? It's like, I don't. Like, you're happier than I might ever be, you know?
Right. Yeah. So, but to your point, that's just what they're wired to say. So the anytime is tough. John Brebbia, I think, had a little bit better perspective on this. John Brebbia asked after the game, oh, you guys, I mean, wow, you finally won. You're going to, you know, celebrate anything differently? He said, quote, a beer shower? What are you talking about? I've never heard of such a thing. That's absurd. Reliever John Brebbia equipped with a straight face after recording the final three outs. Quote, we've got a day game tomorrow, so guys are super focused on getting some sleep, making sure they're eating right and supplementing properly.
I think the White Sox could lose by 25 today.
Yeah. Also, like, knowing John Brebbia, who's a bit of a goofball. This is the thing. This actually goes back to what we're saying about Grifol. There actually are players who would say this 100% genuinely in that room. I don't think John Brebbia is one of them, and that makes me like him more. So that is important context. So I hope they celebrated a decent amount.
One last moment from this White Sox stretch. Okay. Andrew Benintendi, who has unironically played very well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. He, I think, is a great example as to why this team is bad on like a macro level, because he's getting paid the biggest free agent contract in franchise history, and he kind of stinks. He's been great. He catches the final out last night, and this is what he told Sam Blum. Quote, we won a game, nothing more than that. I disagree. I think everyone has played enough baseball. Not me and Jordan. You understand we play 162 of them. I do understand that. It sucks that we've lost 21 in a row, but a win's a win. We're all excited, obviously, but this is no different than any other win. First of all, not true. Sam Blum, who is outstanding at his job, asked Benintendi a phenomenal question. Are you going to keep the ball? And Benintendi said,
wow.
No. Benintendi said no, because this is not something that these people are going to look back on fondly. And Benintendi, that's a fair. Professional who has risen to unbelievable heights in this game, who has won a World Series with the Red Sox, was a top 10 pick, has been amazing. This is not going to fill him with glee, right? He's not proud of this, obviously. And so I'm sure for the Chicago White Sox, it is all about moving on. However, this story is not over. Because the all-time record for most losses of the season, is well within range. And if they continue to rack up L's, and that mark becomes more and more probable, we will certainly take a microscope and continue to glare at what could be the worst team in baseball history.
Yes, this story is not over, and now it is on, you know, it's not the player's fault, but they have the opportunity to do something about it, you know, to a certain degree, and I hope they do. You know, I know we've talked about, but like for the players themselves, I hope that they can find their way out of it. And I hope that they, because now too, this is the other thing is, in August, no one's thinking about spoilers. In September, like this team could ruin some people's seasons in a very, like losing to the White Sox in September. Like I just want to take a glance at their schedule, then we can move on. Like last week of the season, it's really, man, they don't really play anyone that important. They got Boston, okay, Baltimore, Boston, Cleveland to start September, Oakland again, Angels, Padres.
Oh.
Those three Padres games in San Diego, September 20th, September 21st, September 22nd.
And they
Angels and the Tigers.
They like but, crush Cease.
Right. Exactly. Those, if they even get one of those games where the Padres are in all likelihood going to be fiercely jockeying for position in the National League postseason race, just keep an eye on that one, because that's really going to be where this team can really, yeah, beating Cease would really
be Drew Thorpe complete game shutty.
Oh my gosh, yes, Drew Thorpe complete game shutty against Cease. Oh, and then you know it would, and then you need like a Miguel Vargas like three home run game, right? You know, the former Dodger, like.
So the funny so like let's say, you know, they're on the final day of the season, they're 43-118. Okay. Tigers 2003, 43-119. They need a win to stave off history. And they win. And they go to Grifol at the end and he says, you know, anytime you can win a baseball game to avoid being the worst team of all time, that's a great feeling.
You gotta love that.
You got everyone's nodding. Yes, Pedro. Exactly.
Yes. All right. And then I've joked about, for that Tigers series, you know, if they're at the 03 Tigers got to show up to those games. Comerica reunion to cheer on the Tigers to make sure that they are no longer the worst. So we'll see. Anyway. All right. Jake, let's take a break. Okay. Let's take a break. And we return. We are going to talk about Billy Beane. And one of the most important people in baseball over the last few decades. We'll be right back on Baseball Podcast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schuster. News dropped yesterday that Billy Beane died at the age of 60. Of myeloid leukemia, died at his home. He was sick for about a year. And Beane, let's actually start here. His name is Billy Beane. When we say Billy Beane and baseball, 95% of people think about Billy Beane, the Oakland A's GM. And let's just, Billy Beane that we're going to talk about here, no E at the end of Beane. Billy Beane, the one from Moneyball, there is an E at the end. A lot of people, some understandably, some incredibly idiotically, made this mistake yesterday. Mad Dog, just unbelievable, unacceptable doofus performance mixing the two up. Just like,
I didn't even see that. That's horrible.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Like unfathomably obvious. Like, duh, of course he would do that. But I think that is just kind of an important context here. Like, just the people who are listening to this, just know that this is a different Billy Beane. This Billy Beane grew up in Southern California. He went to Loyola Marymount, where he was an extremely talented player. He was drafted by, this is a funny thing in reading about him. He was drafted by the Yankees and offered a $55,000 signing bonus, but like went back to school and then got $12,000, which I don't know, maybe you should have signed.
Signing bonuses in the 80s is kind of a fraught situation.
Yeah.
But yes.
Anyway, he gets drafted by the Tigers, gets up with the Tigers in 1987, plays for them in 87, 88, 89, traded to the Dodgers, plays for them in 89 as well, goes to Japan, then spends 3 years with the San Diego Padres in 93, 94, 95. He was a career 226, 266, 308 hitter, very talented player who wasn't quite fast enough to play center field and wasn't quite good enough with the bat to stick anywhere else. But the reason that we're talking about a player with negative two career wins is that a couple of years after he retired, Billy Beane came out as gay, becoming what we believe to be the second former player to ever do that after Glenn Burke, who came out. Glenn Burke played for the Dodgers and came out, I believe, in 1994 and passed away in 1995. But for Beane, it was particularly notable because he was like, for Burke never had the opportunity, because he died young, to kind of become a symbol for people. And Beane did. Beane did do that. And then starting, I believe, around 2014, Beane went to work for the league. And his role with the league was incredibly important, because for those of you who have not spent time around Major League Baseball players or baseball at all, it is an incredibly homophobic environment, right? I don't want to paint it with maybe with that broad of a brush, but let me just say it this way. There's a lot of homophobia around the game, you know, and I don't think that that's particularly unique compared to other professional sports. I do think it maybe is a little bit worse based upon the demographics of the sport. But Beane's job at the commissioner's office was to be the senior vice president for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, his job was basically to try and help fight back against the blatant homophobia that existed in certain corners of the game. And what that meant was going to talk to big league clubhouses every year to develop relationships with the players to try and improve the state of play in those rooms. That is an incredibly admirable thing to spend your time doing. And his passing is an incredibly, I mean, dying at 60 is just so, so sad. But he was such an underratedly important figure behind the scenes to help push baseball to a place where it needs to be.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to make too crude of a comparison here, but, you know, you mentioned, you know, sharing a name with Billy Beane, and like Billy Beane is thought as this important person. And even 10 years ago, right before we really understood Billy Beane's story, before he was hired by MLB, which I remember when that happened. And I don't know if we have, I think I
met
actually,
him a couple times.
Yeah. I think I remember I met him when I covered, when we were still working for MLB in 2020, I went and covered what is now a program that is mostly held remotely, the Rookie Development Program, which is an event that MLB used to hold and still holds in some forms in the offseason, where it's basically every team sends five or so of their prospects who are expected to be in the big leagues in the near future for like a couple days of programming to get them ready to become major leaguers. And I met Billy Beane at that program and saw him speak there. That's another example, right? And this was whatever, 5 years ago, where he is going to speaking to players at all levels, not just the big league clubhouses, players who are coming up, younger players who in theory, you know, in an optimistic version are more used to being around people that are not straight, right? Who are more used to it. But again, it's getting that to them as early as possible in their professional careers to understand his story and his experience so many years ago, and how that is still an experience that a lot of players in all likelihood are still experiencing now, and making that as easy as possible for those who are either still experiencing and still, you know, not out, or those who are out to certain people. And I bring all that up to say is that, like, over the last 10 years, when I hear Billy Beane, like, this is who I think of, because if I know of how important he has become, and just not just when we worked for the league, but understanding, talking to players, and as we've started to have a few stories of players who have come out after, right? With TJ House, a pitcher who pitched for Cleveland in the major leagues, came out after he, like, we have had other versions. We had a minor leaguer with the White Sox, Anderson Comas, who came out as well while he was still with the organization. These are just a few examples. However, these are massive strides and massively big developments in this space.
So the quote that stuck with me when I you know, saw the news yesterday and just started doing some reading. I tweeted this article out, but kind of the story about Billy Beane in the New York Times from 1999, which I guess was considered his public coming out. We'll talk a little bit about more a little bit more about that later, like coming out in like this public sense. It was explained to me was like concentric circles. Like there are certain people who Billy Beane definitely had come out to previously, right? But when you're, there's an article about you in the New York Times that is about as big of a circle as it gets. Yeah. But there's a quote in there that's, for 9 years, I felt as though I had one foot in the major leagues and one on a banana peel, right? Billy Beane was living a difficult existence as a big league player because he didn't feel like he could be himself. That, we can all agree, I certainly hope, is not ideal. We want all players to feel empowered to be them their true selves so that they can have the best career possible. And Beane's college teammate, Jim Brewski, who played with him at Loyola Marymount and ended up playing in the big leagues, he has a quote in this New York Times article that I think is really insightful. It says, quote, he was right to keep it a secret. The guys would have been brutal. Billy could have been a great player, but he tried too hard to make everyone happy. He wanted everyone to like him, and he put too much pressure on himself. I'm glad it's out. I told him it would have no impact on our friendship.
Yeah. And that's like a difficult thing to read. It's like partially, okay, you have that where it's like there's a level of acceptance, but then it's also the level of he was right to keep it a secret. I think that's what's really difficult, you know, and such a personal thing. It's such a personal choice, and obviously not something that we can speak to, obviously, for sure. And that's still true to this day. But it is kind of a reminder of what the dynamic was then and what is likely still the dynamic to some degree, even, you know, 25 years later.
Now I just want to read an email from a friend of the show, Gabby, who sent this in yesterday. Gabby is one of our favorite people. She is in our Yahoo Sports Fantasy League, which I admittedly have not been keeping up with because I'm a bad person. But Gabby says, hey, guys. I just found out that Billy Beane passed away and I'm completely devastated. Reading his book as a teenager and seeing him share such brave stories made me feel proud to be a queer baseball fan. Many people have talked about how Billy Beane's bravery makes it more likely a gay player will come out during his career. Whether or not that's true, I know there's a community of gay players who live semi-out lives. I imagine those dudes are just gutted. I'm sure it's hard to replicate what he did for making gay players feel safe in the sport. Something I thought might be an interesting insight: coming out happens in concentric circles. A queer person might be out to their friends, but not their family, or maybe they're out when they work jobs abroad, but not in their home countries. I know no gay players come out publicly, but there's still an LGBT community within the sport that is living as out to their friends, family, and likely to other queer people in the sport who this loss will really impact. I'm sure there were guys who only told Billy himself. In the future, I hope more can be done in the MLB. Come on, Gabby, the MLB, you're better than that. I hope more can be done in MLB that treats these men as a community who are allowed to live and air their grievances in a semi-private circle. I believe likely Billy helped to foster this network, and I hope the community effort doesn't die with him. Again, I hope you're both well. Jake, I hope to continue to beat you in fantasy this week. Best, Gabby. Gabby, don't worry. I haven't checked my lineup in 4 months. This is the impact of Billy Beane, right? There are players who are not out publicly, players who are out privately. Billy Beane being a visible character certainly allowed that network to thrive and to help players feel more comfortable. That is so important. And I am hopeful that there will be people to continue on that legacy.
Yeah. And the book she's referencing, which is Billy Beane, Going the Other Way, an intimate memoir of life in and out of Major League Baseball, obviously will... It already is, but will kind of stand up as a very important historical document. And to her point, I think she's absolutely right. You know, we know he has spent time in major league clubhouses during the season, before the season, as I mentioned, talking to minor league players as well. Those are relationships, and anybody who has met him, he is extremely
so nice.
He's someone you want to be friends with. And so he is the, in that sense, such a perfect voice and person to connect and to make an impact, not just on people who may be part of this community and are looking for support, you know, in a more behind the scenes setting, but also as someone that to the average straight player that maybe has never had a gay friend in their life or knows somebody that's queer, it's like, oh yeah, like he is the perfect person to have that be a baseball, you know, centric introduction to that space. And so I think that's what's been so important about what he's been able to do. And obviously it's tragic that, you know, he was only able to hold this post for 10 years, because this is someone that is, like, as we said, like one of the most important people working for Major League Baseball. And so I don't know who that is individually that is going to be able to carry that on. But I just hope that what he had already accomplished and the infrastructure that he had kind of put in place, he obviously should not have been responsible to carry this on his own. That was true 30 years ago, but also even now, it should not all be on Billy Bean to bring baseball into a more progressive and accepted space. But I hope that there are enough people that can continue to do that moving forward.
I want to shout out a guy by the name of Brian Ruby, who was an out player in the minor leagues, or I believe in independent ball for a little bit, but he started an organization called Proud to Be in Baseball, right? That works on kind of educating and advocating for gay players around the country to kind of make them feel more comfortable being themselves. Brian Ruby is someone who, you know, very small world. His sister, I believe, went to college with me and I like knew her. But Brian has done a bunch of good stuff and is clearly spending a lot of time doing this type of thing. One other person that deserves a mention is, I mean, our first friend in baseball, really. Kieran Lovegrove, for those of you who've listened to the show for a long time, you know how much we adore Kieran and how long we've known Mr. Love Glove. But, you know, Kieran came out as bisexual in an ESPN article in 2021 to June Lee, good friend of ours, and he said, quote, "Baseball is a game of statistics. If you want to tell me that I'm the only queer person in baseball, I'm just not going to agree with you. Someone is terrified because it's a terrifying prospect to come out. I do encourage any one of them to reach out to me." Kieran also told a story about how he kind of accidentally offhand came out to his teammates and they were all like totally chill with it and it didn't make any kind of an impact. That totally depends on the circumstance, right? It's great that Kieran had such a positive experience. Not everyone has that type of positive experience. There's still a lot of homophobia around the game. The Texas Rangers are the only team now that does not have a Pride Night. That has a lot more to do with the ownership situation there than really anything rotten within the bones of the organization. And we saw when Anderson Comas, a minor leaguer with the White Sox, came out a couple of years ago, he's now playing independent ball. A number of big leaguers like quote tweeted that on Twitter to show their support. Vinny Pasquantino, Taiwan Walker, Mark Canna. Things are better now than they were 15 years ago is my understanding. Doesn't mean that they're perfect or good, right? And a lot of the reason that it is better now than it was is because of Billy Bean.
Yep, well said. And yeah, I mean, like we've already mentioned, like, let's just hope that this can be a call to action and continued. I mean, activism is not really the right word in this space, but advocacy. Just education, advocacy. Yeah, advocacy. And understanding and to Kieran's point, it is a math prop, you know, it's just people, you know, and by the way, I mean, this is kind of a flippant way to put it. There's also just more Major League Baseball players now more than ever because of how many people are coming up and down. Like, there are absolutely queer people in Major League Baseball. And I hope, and I do believe we will see it, you know, we will see, you know, someone come out and be open in Major League Baseball. And Billy Bean will be the first person that is mentioned, you know, when that happens. And so that'll be a really big deal. And obviously, you know, our thoughts are with Billy's family and just everyone that got to know him even a little bit like we did.
Oh, yeah.
He was a one hell of a person.
And the last thing I'll say before we take a break, what a legacy, you know? I mean, a real, in some ways, a charmed life, in some ways, a burdened life, but I think when you look back on 60 years lived, they are a very important 60 years to be proud of. All right, let's take a quick break, and when we return, we will do more podcasting. And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Hey, buddy, I just checked and the calendar says August 7th. Time flies when the NL wildcard race is a mess. And the season is slowly reaching its inevitable conclusion. And I thought it would be a good time to freeze everything and check in on the awards. Who did we think was going to win these awards at the beginning of the year? Who are the favorites now? And if we voted, who would we vote for? Now, before we begin, Jordan, I should ask, do you have a vote this year for any of these awards?
No, I'm pretty sure I would know by now. because I when I had an NL Rookie of the Year vote last year, I knew about it far in advance. So I don't believe I do. Do you?
I certainly don't. Now, just so everyone knows, Jordan and I are both members of the Baseball Writers Association of America, the organization that votes on both the Hall of Fame and the end of season awards. You cannot vote on the Hall of Fame until you have 10 years of service time. Neither of us have that or even close. This is our second season. And the way that voting works for end of season awards is that each market, each team gets basically two votes.
Market.
So like each, each
chapter, or whatever.
Chapter gets two votes. Those votes are kind of given out to different people in different years. In the New York chapter, where there are 7,000 people, I will certainly never get a vote, which I is fine.
Don't say that, but it's certainly fine with me.
I don't particularly mind. Yeah. Jordan, on the other hand, in the Cincinnati chapter, where there are six people, got a NL Rookie of the Year vote in his first year last year.
Yeah, I don't know if the Cleveland chapter is a little bit more competitive whenever I make the switch over there next season. But no vote for me this year. But we are going to talk about it. And the way I think we're going to do this, you have organized as well. While we don't particularly care about gambling at all, it is a helpful, when we refer to like over-unders for win totals, like looking at odds from the start of the season is at least a helpful reminder of just like where we were, where things were at, and kind of how the market and how just people, the average fan was feeling about these races going into the season. And when you compare those odds from opening day to now, that is instructive. Even if we, this is not gambling advice, we don't know how to give that, we don't care, but it is a good way to be like, oh, okay, Corey Seager and Julio Rodriguez were, you know, 3-4 or tied for third for the best odds for MVP, AL MVP going into the season. That ain't the case anymore.
Yeah.
So that's a good reminder of like, we were like, yeah, Julio, he could absolutely be the guy. Obviously, some other guys have more held steady and other guys have certainly improved their odds.
So just very simple. Zero is like even odds, and then minus is like favorite, and plus is the other way. And just,
I honestly, even trying to do explain more than
no
that
idea
is bad. So
we don't know.
I'm sure we'll say stupid things about the numbers. I'd rather just go in the order of the players that are, you know, from favorite to, you know, least favorite.
So just quickly, top five on opening day, AL MVP: Judge, Soto, Seager, Julio, Yordan Alvarez. Top five in AL MVP now. This is all from BetMGM. I just picked one: Judge, Bobby Witt, Gunnar Henderson, Juan Soto, Jose Ramirez.
Huge gap, right? I mean, the top four are really far ahead of everybody else. Now, we should mention that Bobby Witt was, I believe, fifth on opening day, tied with Adley Rutschman. Sixth. So he was right there. But right now, with the AL MVP, I mean, we don't have to spend too much time on this.
It's Judge if he doesn't get space jammed or
the only way it's not Judge is basically he gets hurt and the Royals make the playoffs. I mean, and Bobby Witt plays every game the rest of the season and finishes with 9 or 10 WAR. Like, I do think that, I mean, it's still going to require Judge to like probably miss significant time, but otherwise, I don't really see how he's not going to win, and which is fine. He deserves it. I mean, I guess some people will make the case for Bobby Witt because he's a shortstop. He's a great defensive shortstop, and he is obviously, he does not have another potential MVP finalist on his team, right? So,
I mean, Aaron Judge's WRC plus is like 216.
No, I know. Again, I'm not. I'm just saying that like if that comes down to 180, 190 and Bobby Witt's at 170 and the Royals make the playoffs after being horrible last year.
Judge has to get hurt tonight.
If the vote is tomorrow, he wins unanimously. I think there's a world where Bobby Witt gets first place votes. I'm just going to say that.
If I had to put it in order, top three, I would go Judge, Witt, Soto, probably Gunner fourth.
Yeah.
Where you at?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's totally fine. I love like looking at past the top few. I could see Ramirez or Devers working their way into third. If Soto just like, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. And by the way, especially now that like we have plenty of precedent of teammates finishing in the top three recently, like it's happened a bunch. There's no reason why Soto can't finish in the top three as well.
But AL MVP, Judge, Witt, Henderson, yep. Soto, clear top four. Yep. Let's move on to the NL MVP. We're on opening day. Opening day, there was a favorite, and his name was Ronald Acuña Jr., who won the NL MVP last year. He obviously had a bad first 2 months and then tore his ACL, so he will not be winning it. Mookie Betts had the second best odds. He looked like a pretty good bet. He was probably leading the running until he broke his hand.
Yeah, yeah.
Third on the list.
So he's missed too much time, yeah. Right? I mean, he's still going to end up with a pretty ridiculous line, but it's just not going to be in enough games. So, like, I wouldn't be surprised if he still gets down ballot votes,
yeah.
But he's obviously not going to win.
He'll give votes.
Yeah. So right now, the favorite is this gentleman named Shohei Ohtani looking to win an NL MVP. And it is now, while he did enter the season with the third best odds, at least according to what we are looking at, like, we really were not, like, I mean, so much of it was because of how much we were just like Acuña, like, oh my God, which was totally deserved. But it's very simple. It was like, all right, like, he could be amazing. He's still a DH and he still has Mookie and Freddie on his team. And like, what is he? How much better is he really going to be offensively to where he's not pitching and can he win his DH? And the answer is a lot better. And even with all the positional adjustments for being a designated hitter, he is leading the National League in Fangraphs WAR. He is just ahead of Ellie De La Cruz, who is not currently at the odds we're looking at, the second favorite. He is fifth on these lists. Now, that is because the Reds are not that close to the postseason. However, I am interested, like, right now, would you say, like, I still feel like Ellie has a good chance to finish higher than fifth.
I want to start. You got to spend more time on Ohtani. We got from Eric who said, hey, everyone, Ohtani currently has 34 homers and 32 steals and might go 45-45 and no one's talking about it. What's going on? Now, there are two answers. One is that Acuña did it last year, and so our brains are warped. And two is that the new rules make it a little bit easier. Still, incredibly impressive. 45-45 would be the first time ever. That would be totally bananas. And I want to say a big reason why Ohtani will win, in my opinion, and why, like, I think I would vote for him is the steals. Like, he is running at such a ridiculous rate for a guy with that much power. It's so impressive. Now, I'm not going to lie. You ready for an old man take? Please. I don't feel great about having a DH win. I don't feel great about it. And the reason is he's not out there in the heat, Jordan. He's not banging his body up against the walls. He's not on his feet diving for stuff. He's not out in the field. All he's got to do is take that bat and go swing it, I guess, and do his pitching rehab. Ohtani, it's a little different. Like, I'm willing to, obviously, no duh. Like, it's a little different because the only reason he's de-aging is because his arm is being healed over time.
Right.
That being said,
he's not a DH in spirit. He is DH by necessity. And but I hear you.
I would vote for Judge, Witt, Soto, maybe Gunner over him if he was still in the AL. Admittedly.
Now obviously he pitched last year. He has the same OPS plus as he did last year. Exactly right now, 184. He has, but to your point, blasted past the stolen bases, right? And the rules were in place last year and he stole 20.
Because he was pitching. He was just pitching.
He was pitching. He was conserving more energy, but he still played 135 games. Like, he was, you know, he could have probably done more than that. He might steal 40 bases. I had the moment where I was like, wait a minute, like, did he just set the single season record for steals by a DH? And he did, and no one said anything. Like, I literally just looked it up. Like, it was like, yeah. So anyway, but also, again, it's a weird thing. There aren't people that are fast that are playing DH all the time. That's like not, he just is in the ways that he has many times. He has kind of broken our understanding of like what a player should be or can be. But I do think that how he's been able to defy the positional adjustments for defenses is wild. Like, that is so, it shows how good he's been offensively at a time, remember, where it is harder to hit. Like, offense is down. He's hitting .306. He has a chance at the triple crown. That's in play, right? Even if you want to go full old school.
Friends, he has a higher batting average than Luis Arraez. Luis Arraez is the batting average guy. That's like his only bit. And Ohtani's hitting 306, yeah. Arise hitting 305.
What's Arise's hard hit rate and barrel rate and average exit velocity?
I'm not trying to dunk on Luis Arise here, but the point is Ohtani is a freak and is amazing.
Yeah.
It is a relatively weak field, I think, in the National League this year because offense is down.
That's not his fault.
Yeah. Below Ohtani on the odds right now, it goes Ketel Marte, amazing. Francisco Lindor, Bryce Harper, Ellie De La Cruz. Now, this order is maybe not where the voting would be now, but projected over the rest of the year. I think Bryce is the one where if he catches fire, as he seems to do so often, he could pop his name up into the conversation a little bit more. Harder for him because now he's playing third base. Yes, it's a good third base, Yes, it's a good first base, but it's still first base.
Like, did I miss something? I know.
Yeah, he and Alec Boehm switched. Lindor and Marte deserve to be in the conversation. Ellie has all the steals. Marcelo Zuna has been, you know, so good offensively this year. To me, it's pretty clear top six. I think that's how that'll be the top six when it's all said and done. Ohtani, Marte, Lindor, Harper, De La Cruz, and Ozuna.
Yeah, I think
Ellie is 58
been awesome.
Steals.
Ketel's been so awesome. Oh, I know. You don't got to tell me about Ellie. I think right now I would go Bryce. Man, I don't know. That's so disrespectful to Martin Lindor. If I had to guess, though, like I feel like Bryce is going to benefit. Like he's going to probably have the best player on the best team, kind of like standard NFL quarterback MVP kind of thing. And in that sense, I think he will finish in the top three. And I think I think he's got a shot here. Lindor and Marte are so awesome. They're going to probably, whether it's fair or not, it might come down to just where their teams end up. So we'll see.
AL Cy Young. Let's talk about it. Beginning of the season. The odds were fascinating. Yes. Gerrit Cole was not in the mix because his injury came out and everyone knew about it on opening day. On opening day, I would say there was a pretty clear top eight. All right. Corbin Burns, Kevin Gausman, Luis Castillo of the Mariners, Framber Valdez, congrats on the almost no-no, Tarik Skubal, Pablo Lopez, George Kirby, Cole Reagans. That was like a pretty clear top eight. Odds kind of drop off after that. Grayson Rodriguez, Logan Gilbert, Nady Evaldi, Shane Bieber before he blew out. Right now, it seems like it's Tarik Skubal's to lose. He is number one in the betting market. Then it is Corbin Burns, Seth Lugo, George Kirby, and a huge drop off after that.
So I think the big thing, big takeaway here, right, is like Reagans and Skubal had all this hype, and Skubal in particular, I mean, I've said it before on the show, like, boy, has he delivered. It's not that I was skeptical, but for him to like pitch his way into like Cy Young favorite in a way where like if he had just done what he was like, if he was just an all-star and, you know, one of the 10 best pitchers in the league, I would have said, great, he did it. You know, he became what we expected. Instead, he like has a case for being the best pitcher in baseball this year. But Burns has also held steady. The thing is, I'm not sure Burns has really, I know who the odds are better now than they were on opening day, but that's just because the field's been whittled down. It's hard for me to say that he has like exceeded expectations.
I think I totally disagree. I mean, he's a 2.63 ERA with the third most innings in the American League.
But is that exceeding expectations?
Maybe our expectations about any pitcher should not be to have a 2.63 ERA and 100.
I think for Corbin Burns, he's like one of the three guys he was the favorite. Like this isn't saying I'm not impressed with his season. Yeah. I'm just saying he's kind of done what they brought him there to do, which is good. That's good. That's important.
He's striking out fewer batters than he's ever struck out.
Yeah. Too. And like he's throwing more strikes than he did last year, right? Like last year, there were some signs that he was getting unlucky. He was much better in the second half. And so I'm not saying he's not deserving, but like right now, I mean, if it stays as it is, I think Skubal is going to win fairly easily. And I think he would deserve it. And in terms of other guys that really have a chance, I mean, the odds suggest Lugo's there just because he's, you know, been so consistent and has racked up the innings, but I don't know. Like, do you really see if Skubal kind of stays on pace and stays healthy? Burns probably is still the second best challenger. I know George Kirby is leading baseball in F4 because he throws so many strikes and, you know, it's fit based. So you have that going for you. But yeah, so I don't know. I think Scooble, it's Scooble's to lose.
Yeah, Scooble's to lose. I would go Scooble, Lugo, Burns. I am a huge believer in innings as a Cy Young category.
Yeah.
And specifically, I am a big believer
ahead.
In.
He is
way ahead. Yeah. And it's innings. For me, it's innings per start. How deep into games are you working? He is number one in innings. He's number one in innings per start. I understand that his ERA is 2.72 and his expected ERA is like a full run higher than that. But when we vote, I believe that when we vote for things, we should be voting on what people did, not what yeah. they were supposed to have yeah. done.
I think
if
that's
we're projecting
totally
forward, like who would I rather have next year? Corbin Burns or Seth Lugo? Like, I hope you all know I think
the market will dictate that pretty clearly in free agency.
However, like fact is Seth Lugo limited runs. That's the job.
Yeah.
And whether that was his doing or the doing of the baseball gods is kind of sort of irrelevant to me. I do think that obviously strikeouts and walks play a role in that. But I would, my order right now would be Scooble, Lugo, Burns. Let's move on to the NL Cy Young. And the main question here is very simple. Can Paul Skeens win?
So he right now has the second best odds. Now, part of that, right, is my understanding is not irrelevant to the how many people are wanting to bet on Paul Skeens right now. Zach Wheeler is third. Chris Sale is the favorite right now. Chris Sale, who was on the board to start the season but was pretty far down to begin the year, Strider obviously off the board now. Zach Wheeler was second. He's right there, has a great chance. Logan Webb, who's, you know, we've seen him runner up. He's kind of fallen off, but he's pitched better lately. Yamamoto was in the top four. That's not happening because of injury, but he's certainly pitched better. Gallen, Fried, Glasnow. Now, Glasnow is an interesting one because Glasnow's odds have dropped since the start of the season, but I feel like he's kind of done what you could have hoped
he
could have been.
Quickly on Glasnow, he is the opposite Seth Lugo, where he has been unlucky and he's missing a ton of bats and his expected ERA is a full run lower than what his real ERA is. He's at like 3.5. It should be around 2.5. I don't care. You didn't do it, right? Maybe you'll do it next year.
He hasn't done it.
We'll see.
I mean, last 2 months, it's not like he's out of range. I mean, if he has a really good last 2 months, he's got a chance.
But to me, I think Skeens is the most interesting part of this conversation because he still does not qualify for innings.
No, he's what, 80 innings? How many innings is he?
So
he's at 86 innings through 14 starts. He ranks 12th in the National League in F4. I mean, what do you need him to get to? Like, he's going to make, what, 10 more starts?
Here's the deal. I actually went and did all this out because I'm a loser. Paul Skeens should probably have 10 more starts if he stays on schedule. That would leave him at 146 innings if he continues to average the same innings per start. He's at 6.1 innings per start. Not 6.33333, like 6.1. Okay? That would put him at 146 innings. The fewest innings ever thrown by a Cy Young Award winner in a full season starting pitcher was Corbin Burns in 2021. He threw 167 innings. So I think if Skeens finishes the year at 146, his numbers need to be absolutely stupid. Yeah. They need to be so much lower than everyone else. Now, if Skeens had a if Skeens had a full season of work, if his innings numbers were right in line with everyone else, I would vote him one. He is second.
That's not a take. Of course,
I understand.
I'll have that conversation next year.
I understand. I just want to give people a perspective on it. Second in K rate and sixth in walk rate. Lowest run. Yeah. Like that does not happen. That's amazing. Second in walk rate, sixth lowest walk rate. He is the sixth lowest opponent batting average. He's number one in whip. He's number one in ERA, and he's fifth in innings per start, which means like he is going deep into games as a rookie despite a pitch count. The sheer innings total is just lower because he didn't get up in time. I don't think you can vote him number one unless Sale and Wheeler get hurt or his numbers are like at a 1.3 or something just totally ludicrous. Where I'm at right now, I would vote Sale, Wheeler, and put Skeens third.
I do think Skeens is going to have a chance because I think he's completely unique situation where he's clearly the story of the season or one of the few stories of the season. I think, too, from a narrative standpoint, I think if he pitches games that keep the Pirates relevant in September, which again, we'll see if that's happening, is also probably going to help him. But it also might just be, it also just might be a situation where it's like, Paul Skeens will be a Cy Young at some point. Why do I need to vote him for the Cy Young this year?
Dude, pitchers are still mad that Burns won. Like people, like I was talking to people.
No, in that's baseball, the thing, right?
People are mad that Skeens. Burns won at 167.
People will be mad if Skeens wins. Yeah.
People are still mad that Blake Snell won over Verlander with 180.
With 180, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, if players are mad. Players aren't voting.
If Skeens wins, I don't know if players aren't voting, dude. But what I just don't think you can give it to a guy with that few innings. I really don't. Like,
that's fine.
That's
I agree.
What the rookie of the year is for. That, and it's not his fault. Fine. Like, to be clear, it's not on him. It's not like Paul Skeens did anything wrong. But, like, you can't give it to a guy with 146 innings. Unless the numbers are totally, totally nuts. All right, let's do our last two here. Okay. Let's do the AL and NL rookies of the year. Coming into the season in the AL rookie of the year was pretty clear favorite with Wyatt Langford at one, Evan Carter at two, Jackson Holliday at three. That looks totally wacko right now. Langford is kind of underwhelmed. Evan Carter has been a non-factor. He's out for the season. Holliday came up, struggled, and he has looked pretty awesome since he came back, but there's just not enough runway for him. And the American League rookie of the year is completely open. Like, totally open. The favorite right now is Colton Cowser of the Baltimore Orioles, who, if he wins, would give the Orioles their third consecutive Rookie of the Year award, which is nuts.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. Oh, wait. That's not true. Julio won over Adley. I'm an idiot.
He did. But in your world, Adley won, and that's okay.
Yeah. at number two is Luis Hill of the Yankees. Three is Austin Wells, Willy Abreu, Sidon Rafaela. And then there's kind of a drop-off after that. Colt Keith, right? I would vote for Luis Hill over Colton Cowser. Where do you add on that?
Yeah, I mean, again, like Luis Hill's got some pretty solid bulk here. I mean, as far as starting pitchers, rookie starting pitchers, you know, throwing a lot of innings is not an insignificant feat, let alone for the Yankees, let alone striking out a ton of guys, let alone with an ERA of 3.2. I mean, he's walking the world. I think he has the highest walk rate almost of any starting pitcher in the league.
Do you know why he's so good at stranding runners?
Yeah, why is that?
God bless him.
That's true. There are some other. See, other pitchers should have gotten the neck tat. They would have been in better shape. I think I would also probably vote for Hill. Although, if Abreu's been so consistent. I know his playing time hasn't been as much there, but I think he's going to have a chance here. You know, he's got the best highest OPS of qualified rookies, and I think he's got a shot. But this one's going to come down to the wire because Cowser's been so hot and cold that, like, he's liable to go really, really cold for 3 weeks. I love the guy and just kind of work his way out of it. But his counting stats are going to be there almost no matter what at this point.
Cowser's numbers are very similar to Abreu if you look at all the stuff from a rate basis. The difference is he's a very good defender. And Abreu is not.
That's fair.
And so I was picking between Cowser and Abreu, I would pick Cowser. That being said, Austin Wells has a 116 WRC plus and is a rookie catcher. That's kind of nuts.
Yeah. I mean, he has 8 home runs. Like, that's not. Yeah, I agree. It's impressive. We were the highest on Austin Wells coming into the year, but like, there's nothing about his stats that are jumping off the page.
I would go Hill, Cowser, Wells is how I would vote. For the NL,
I don't think Wells is finishing in the top three, but I could.
Okay. In the NL, I think it's going to be Paul Skeens.
Who's finishing second? I think it's Merrill's to lose. Like, dude, he's played basically every single game in center field, and like, Imanaga's going to have a lot of innings. Wynn's been awesome. Churio's been great lately. Michael Bush is definitely being underrated. Like, he's been super, but like, the Cubs are not relevant. I don't know. I think Merrill has been just awesome, unless he's really cooled off in the last 3 weeks.
Can I open your eyes maybe a little bit?
Yeah.
What does Jackson Merrill have? I like Jackson Merrill. What does Jackson Merrill have, I guess, besides learning a new position on the fly that Mason Wynn doesn't have? Okay. Rookie playing a premium position. Very well, and their offensive numbers are not that dissimilar. Mason Wynn has a 744 OPS.
Yeah.
Merrill is at 761. Okay.
Yeah.
Wynn, somehow Merrill has more steals, even though Wynn is really fast. Wynn is playing a better shortstop than Merrill's playing center field.
Yes. Yes. Nope. That is totally valid. I do think Mason Wynn's season is going completely underlooked. So underlooked, overlooked. Can you underlook
going overlooked?
Something? I know. I'm just thinking about the English language.
You're looking over it. You're not
underlooked is not a thing you say, but say underrated. So that's interesting.
Overlooked is like you're looking above something, whereas usually the prefix over, you would say you're doing too much of something. Like you're looking too much, but you're really looking
over. So
it's
weird.
It is weird.
God, English sucks. Great point. I don't have a great retort. They've both basically played every day. They're both, you know, similar strikeout rate. You know, Merrill certainly has some more power and has certainly had a lot more big moments. I feel like Merrill has certainly kind of risen in that sense. But no, I think it's completely valid. And that's another one where it's just a matter of, I mean, the learning the new position thing is pretty wild, but ultimately the value is the value. And I think that's interesting.
Shota Imanaga definitely deserves to be in the conversation. I mean, he's kind of bounced back from a really rough stretch in the middle of the season. He was an all-star. I am always skeptical to give Rookie of the Year awards to players who have been professionals in the second best league ever. I mean, it's not Shota Imanaga's fault, but like, what is he, 30?
He's 30, yeah.
He's been a professional. I think something about being a Rookie of the Year is like making the adjustment. Now, yes, he made an enormous adjustment coming to MLB, but he's literally 10 years older than
Jackson Merrill. Yeah, I still think that Imanaga is going to finish pretty high this thing.
I agree.
Especially because he's almost guaranteed to lead all rookies in innings, and he has been pretty steady. He's dealt with some, like, okay, now they're hitting home runs. Okay, now we kind of managed that. Like, he's been really, really, really good.
On my point, like, I know maybe this isn't in the voting. I give a boost to players, like, the younger they are, and maybe detract for them a little bit the older they are.
I agree with that. That's part of why I voted for Eury Pérez last year.
Yeah.
Because what he did, even in a smaller third place, to be clear, but I was the only person that voted for Eury Pérez for NL Rookie of the Year, third place last year, because there were a lot of other great hitters. But I was like, it is so rare for a 20-year-old pitcher to even be a starting pitcher in the major leagues, let alone be this good in a starting pitcher in the major leagues, that I wanted to reward that. So that reverse can kind of be, you know, applied to Imanaga.
And then the last one is Tyler Fitzgerald with the Giants, who's just been en fuego for the last month. If he keeps us up for another 2 months, I mean, you lower that, go ahead and lower that qualified hitter number,
thing.
Jordan.
Here's the thing.
Take that minimum playing time at bats, sort by WRC
plus. Yeah, 150. Yeah, he's top 10 or whatever. But like
Jordan Schusterman, he is not top 10.
Top three.
Jordan, can you let me finish a freaking sentence, big dog?
Yeah.
He has the highest WRC plus in the National League, above Shohei Ohtani.
Oh, above. Okay, sorry. We're just doing National League. Yeah. As 150 plate appearances. But even more simply.
Is he better than Ohtani? I mean, it's worth
even more
asking
simply,
the question.
With 52 games, he's at 12 homers. You know, Colin Cowser's leading all rookies with 16 homers. I mean, he's homering like every other day, so he might pass Cowser in home runs, and he's doing it at shortstop inexplicably. So he'll probably show up on some ballots if he keeps this up. But Rookie of the Year is fun. It sucks that you can only vote for three. That's the worst part. That was what is really, you know, you get 5 for Cy Young, you get 10 for MVP. So the balloting is a little complicated there.
I think that's it, Jordan. There are a couple of other topics that we're just going to blow right
past.
We'll talk about them on Friday.
Yeah.
Baseball at the racetrack. Braves and Reds are going to play at a NASCAR stadium. Framber Valdez almost threw a no-hitter last night. If he got one more out, we would have talked about it more, but we're not because he didn't get it. And then before we go, happy birthday, Mike Trout.
Happy birthday, Mike Trout. Mike Trout's 33 today. And wherever you are, I actually apparently saw he was back on his golf course surveying the land with Tiger Woods. So I hope he's whatever makes you happy, Mike Trout. I hope you're doing that on your 33rd birthday.
I hope he's not walking the full 18 with a torn meniscus. Take that golf cart.
I hope not. Yeah, I'm sure he's got plenty of golf carts at his disposal. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. We appreciate all the emails, including a very good one that I haven't read yet, but is apparently amazing, and we will read on Friday. But until then, enjoy the baseball, and we will talk to you very soon.